something changed with your health, like something new. And I think he wants to heal you. And so I'm like, whatever, you know, like you can pray for me. And I remember he put his hand right here. And I thought he was pulling a prank on me. He's just that kid. Because it got super, super hot. Like super hot. Like to the point where I almost grabbed his hand.
Yeah.
Because I'm like, all right, whatever you're doing here, it's starting to hurt. And he prayed for me, but it was just a sweet, powerful prayer. And I went to go grab his hand, and I felt like just the Lord, something in me, just let it ride.
Yeah.
And he just said some things that no one knew. And I thought it was a good prayer. And it was about 3 days later, I woke up, and all those symptoms were gone. So then I called my doctor, and I said, hey, can we take a test, that pancreatic cancer test again? She's like, we just did that. And so I explained to her what happened. So she did. Came back negative. And I'm like, let's do it one more time. I'm like,
too good to be true.
I'm an engineer. And so, but what, you know, there's just some things I understand, you know, why God healed me of that. And it was almost 2 years later that finally colon cancer was gone. And so there's just some things I don't understand. Right.
Yeah.
And I guess
so that was what years? Oh, are we rolling right now? I might as well start. Just pick
we
it
are,
up.
Yeah, we're rolling. I'm still tweaking a little
bit. Gotcha. Okay. What years were that?
I got to think here. So a year ago is when I got my first negative cancer test whole time. I got diagnosed in 2000.
That was your first negative?
2018. That was my first negative.
God. Really?
Yeah. 6 years?
6 years of fighting. 5 years of fighting in, yeah. Man. And so, and that's a whole crazy thing, because even before I had cancer, a year and a half, well, 3 years before I got cancer, I was in a wheelchair.
Are you rolling right now? Let's just pick it. Just keep telling your story.
I was in a wheelchair, and we didn't know what was wrong. Like, one day I'd walk in, I'd look fine. I would be fine. I'd act fine. I felt good. And then, like, the next day I'd get to about 10 a.m., and all of a sudden my hands would start shaking.
Yeah.
I'd lose control of my legs. I'd lose all energy and power. I'd develop a stutter. Sometimes I'd black out.
And now this was when?
This is about 3-4 years before the cancer diagnosis.
Okay, so 2015.
14, 15. And tried to, you know, we went to the hospitals. The first time it happened to me, we thought we were having a stroke. They made me go to the emergency room.
Yeah.
Went to Janesville, Madison, ended up at Mayo. Mayo couldn't figure it out.
Yeah.
I think about a year and a half of testing. They're like, man, we thought it'd be autoimmune, but it's not doing that. We could tell my body was kind of eating itself. That was the first thing, you know, I was in Janesville and they did some surgery on me, removed some lymph nodes because they weren't sure what was up. And my wife said the doctor came with a vial of them and was like, we've never seen this before. They cut out some lymph nodes and he shook it and they just dissolved. And he says, your body's like eating the lymphatic system. And so I went to Mayo. They did a bunch of testing, couldn't figure anything out.
And these include like cancer tests at that point, right?
Yeah, no
and
cancer.
Nothing everything's popped free and up clear. At that point. It was 2018.
So it was three, four years, like you said before.
Okay. Yeah.
And it just progressively kept getting worse. And about 2 months after that, I was driving up north to do some sales and visit some customers. And I was coming home. It was February. Won't forget it. It was like negative 17 degrees. And I just started getting really sick. Started losing control of my legs again. Mm. Pulled over on the side of the road. And I don't know how to explain it, but I just felt like death was at my door. And I climbed in the back seat. And I just remember praying to God, like, man, I think this is going to be it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I'm going to wake up from this. And I remember saying, like, I remember telling God, like, I feel good about my family. Like, you'll take care of my family. I know you will. But I just realized I'm a really big micromanager. I don't know that my business will go on without
me. That's what popped into your mind.
That was. And my wife laughs about that. But I remember just telling God, if I wake up, I need to change the way I run my business.
Yeah. Well, you're a caring person, so you're probably thinking about your employees in that moment. And then indirectly, that's what pops into your head. Well, how many employees did you have at that point?
We had, I think it was like 20-some odd employees.
Yeah.
And I fell asleep. And the next thing I know, I woke up and a guy was beating on my truck door. My truck ran out of gas. I was freezing. And he was getting ready to bust the glass out. And I opened the door. And man, I never got his name, nothing. And he drove me to the gas station. We got gas. And he gave me something to eat. And I just remember... It was so weird, but he just asked me if I was okay, and I just kind of told him, man, just going through a rough time here, and got me gas. He says, you need anything else? We got the truck. I don't know how we got the truck running. It was so cold. I'm surprised the lines weren't froze, but we got it running, and I drove home, and I told Mary, I said, I think we need to change some things up here, and I started changing the whole way I ran the business and everything else, so I got my...
And this is still 2014-15?
Yeah, 14-15.
Okay. All right.
Got the team together, and I came up with this. I have a friend of mine, Tim, who is a great guy. He's really good at business and kind of ran this whole idea by him. He was helping me out with my business coaching me, so to speak. And I said, man, I think I'm doing this all wrong. I don't even think this way. I think we need to value the culture and the hour more than the dollar. Mm-hmm. I said, I really believe they'll follow. And I just kind of took it from just honestly... Me and my wife have had tenants in our life that we've made decisions off of. Her and I sat down and wrote out these tenants, and they're all biblically based. But there's about 14 of them. And I said, I want everybody to know what they are. Mm-hmm. That way I could give them the sheet of paper, so to speak, with the tenants and the definitions, and they could always make the right decision. Maybe not the best, but the right one.
Yeah.
And then we started empowering them. So I got a team.
Best decision for, well, potentially you impact them personally too. Hopefully. But also for the company, both, right?
Right. Right. Yeah. I mean... And our goal was never to be in business to make. I've never chased wealth in my life. Mm-hmm. Just not anything on my radar.
Yeah,
probably because of my growing up. But we went back and I grabbed 8 of my team members that were the closest to us that had really shown a lot of heart. And we sat them down. I unveiled this whole like program to them, and we started empowering them. And we lost a lot of money at first. We knew we would because there would be mistakes. There would be. But we really started going after the culture and making this culture where we valued everybody's time. Time's the only resource we can never get back. Dollars you can.
Sure.
And so we just started building that. And the next thing you know, the business is taking off. We're growing. We designed and developed and invented, I think it was like 6 new systems in the course of like 2 years. And then I really got to focus on the vision side of the company, new tech, the culture. And when I was sick, my wife ran the company. We grew faster than we ever did when she ran it.
Yeah, all because of what you put in place there, too. Obviously, your wife's probably a beast, but like obviously the things that you kind of put in place. Culture, and all of a sudden it's going to drive itself a little bit.
And it did. And so at that point, I was only meeting with them once a week for a couple hours. And the rest of the time, I got to dream and meet with customers, do strategy. And my wife did such a good job, I think, because she's this kind of lady where she's unassuming. She's super brilliant, and she's just the lady. Well, you just don't want to disappoint her. Like the guys and gals would always say, like, we just don't want to make Miss Mary disappointed, you know. That's funny. So, she did really good from that. But then, I had a dream in that truck. That's where I was going with this. Sorry, in that truck, I had a dream, and it was 2 Amish men came up to me, and the one on the right said, "We're going to help you. We'll help you get healthy again." And I didn't think, when I woke up, all that is a very vivid memory for me. There's about 1.5 years during that time, I don't remember. Like some of the stories I'll tell you are just regurgitated. But it was about 3 months later, I was in an oil
field. During your actual cancer portion?
No, this is still me in the wheelchair.
Oh, still even doing that?
Yeah.
Got it.
And it all leads to something, bear with me. So about 3 months after that truck, we're implementing things. I was down in Kentucky in an oil field working down there. And I had what I call one of my episodes, and my buddy Michael saw it, and it freaked him out. And I was telling him what had been happening, and I didn't tell him about the dream, but I just told him, I said, man, I'd just do anything to have an answer. And he's like, well, there's an Amish doctor that John Hopkins even sends people to one time. He looks in their eye, and he can figure out what's wrong with them. And I'm like, I'll try anything.
Yeah.
So we go to this Amish community, and we finally found it after a day of searching, and they were closed. And we were pulling out, and an Amish fella had stopped and said, hey, is there anything I can help you with? And Michael's like, my buddy's really sick. You know, no one's been able to figure him out. And so he says, well, why don't you go down that road? The doctor lives all the way at the end of that road.
So we go to the doctor's house. This is like 1920s, 30s stuff.
Oh, just so rolling into their house. So back there, yeah, right? Yeah. And we first thing we do is we start driving down this one-lane road, and on the right-hand side, there's literally 2 horses on a treadmill. This is not a lie. Yeah. They're on a treadmill walking in the same place. Huh. Water coming across on water trough and oats up here. And here they're grinding up stuff for the community. Uh-huh. That's what they're doing. And so we drove for a while. We're like, man, we drove for like 1 mile or 2, didn't see his house. But there were a bunch of Amish farmers. And so Michael's like, well, let's stop and ask them. So we stop, and two farmers come walking up, and I told Michael, I said, that guy on the right is from my dream. I said, he's the doctor. And he's like, no, he's a farmer. I'm like, I'm telling you, that's the guy from my dream who said he'd help me. And come
this
find
is like,
out.
This is, I don't want to cut you off. I'm sorry.
No, you're right.
But this is like hard to even believe.
I can understand that.
It's crazy. No, keep going.
But he comes up, he talked to Michael. And what I do remember is Michael said something like, well, Don's a good man. And the doctor turned to me and says, is that true? You're a good man. I said, no, there's only one that's good. And he just got a big smile on his face. He says, I'll see you. He says, I'm going to hitch up my buggy and wagon. He says, I'll meet you at the clinic. Now, the clinic is like maybe three times this size.
Yeah.
No electricity.
So 400 square feet, 300 square feet.
And it's just, you step in the Amish community, you're stepping back into like the early 1900s.
Sure. Yeah.
But he looked at my eyes. Weirdest thing ever. He's like, oh, I see you had surgery on your in your left lymph. It looks like you had some lymph nodes removed. And wow, it looks like you're missing lymph node. And he's telling me stuff like, how are you telling me this?
Mm-hmm.
Didn't ask me anything about my health. Didn't care. And he tells me all this stuff, and I was hooked. Now, up to this moment, if you took a vitamin, I was the guy that laughed at you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I lived on energy drinks and fast food.
Yeah.
And what I didn't eat was fast food. It was high carbs and high fat. But he changed my life, and he got me out of that wheelchair, and I got healthy. I was feeling good. And then a year and a half after really feeling good, company's doing good. We're almost 50 employees. We were rampant. Me and my wife were looking at 10 other companies. We wanted to buy three more companies. We wanted to grow to about $150 million in annual sales in 5 years. And I just wasn't feeling right. Got called from Mr. Forbes and Bruce to come and sit on a panel and be a keynote speaker.
Yeah.
And on my way down, I stopped to see my doctor, and that's where he told me.
Hmm. What did the Amish doctor do to get you out of the wheelchair? What all was in that mix?
Oh, man.
I'm sure there's a lot. I'm sure there's a lot to it.
But there was a lot to it. But it was first thing. So the way he looks at anything, whether it be cancer or this, is he's not symptom based.
Mm-hmm.
So okay, these are what you're feeling, but he says let's get the diagnostics. Yeah. So the big thing is anything that's an imbalance, any health issue, they believe it's because we're missing something in our nutrition system.
Yeah, I'm 100% on board with that. Yeah.
Okay. And so if you're missing that, your body needs, it's like a big chest.
I'm not vaxxed. I'm not, so like,
okay.
So you're not going to offend me. It's like
a safe place.
Yeah,
it's a safe place.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, so it's like, I 100% I believe like what you put in your body. I'm all about, I get it.
Well, if this tells you anything, because when you said Joel had reached out, Mary was asking me, she's like, are you going to call Joel? I'm like, nope. I said, I trust him.
Yeah, yeah.
So this makes me, you know, I did trust you. I didn't call you, did I?
No.
Because I thought, all right, if he recommended it, it's all right. But, so it's like a chessboard. Think of it this way. Our body needs every piece of that chessboard filled to top rate.
Mm-hmm.
Some is minerals, some is vitamins, some is hormones, some is even fat, some of it's lipids, whatever it may be, right? If we're missing those, our body gets out of balance. Well, all of our nutrition comes from the ground, whether we want to believe it or not.
Mm-hmm.
Because either the animals we eat out of the ground or the farmer's field.
Mm-hmm.
And Jake, he can literally tell where someone's kind of from, what region, by looking at their eyes and what they're missing. Because it kind of goes.
Jake is the Amish doctor.
He's an Amish doctor, okay. Yeah. And so we started. Number one is he talked about absorption. It was a great book, very disgusting book that I read. Changed my life.
Hmm.
Bernard Jensen's book on gut health, you know, digestive system.
Okay.
And what it is it starts with absorption. Because of all the junk we've put in our body, we slow our absorption. We don't absorb as much, and we deprive our bodies. Number two is our land is not as healthy as it was.
Mm-hmm.
Now, mind you, Jake said this 8 years ago to me. He says, Don, soon you're going to see that carnivore diets become very popular. He says, and here's why. He says, they'll work. They'll make people feel better. But long term, it's not the good goal. He says, balanced meals are, balanced nutrition. He says, because farmers can feed their animals better than they can feed their land.
Mm-hmm.
And he says the biggest impact to human health is our growth of our ground.
Hmm.
And so we went down this journey of, you know, fasting along with juicing, along with whole foods, organic foods, stripping everything down, reducing sugars, doing a lot of high mineral type food, and starting to build that up. And so it was about it was probably 6 months once I started. I didn't feel well at first. I don't know that it helped me. But once we started working on Bernard's treatment and really, you know, fixing your colon, fixing your digestive system, bringing up in, your absorption, things started to get better. And it was about 6 months after I started noticing different than a year after that, I felt better than I think I ever had in my life.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt brighter. I felt more energy.
Yeah.
And I still have an immune system issue that will fight the rest of my life. It's just damage. There's not a whole lot you can do. If I was younger, he kind of felt like maybe that would regenerate. But and that's what we started. And so it's really about taking a holistic approach of how do we balance the body? What do we do?
Yeah.
And much like with cancer, the way he doesn't like even calling it cancer, right? He doesn't like calling cancer because he's like, I don't believe cancer is the problem. It's a flag of what's wrong.
Yeah.
Because we all have cancer. We naturally suppress it. The question is, why does our body stop?
So you were diagnosed with pancreatic first or
no, colon?
Colon first. Yep. And then how long after that was pancreatic? A couple years?
Yeah, it was about 2-3 years into the journey.
In your documentary, you talk about you flew to see your doctor. So Jake is who you flew to?
Yeah, I go to see him.
Go to see him.
Yeah. So after he gave me the diagnosis, I had an hour-long drive with no cell phone. You don't get on your cell. I mean, he's in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah.
And
so you take a plane and then you drive another hour and a half, two mm-hmm. hours, and you're at his place.
Right.
And you're driving back.
Thinking about it. And then I went to Forbes. I hopped right on a plane and went to Forbes.
Oh,
highlight of my career, right?
Yeah.
My team that we built, my team that has worked so hard, we're finally getting recognition. The business is going good. I went to California, walked away with hundreds of millions of dollars of VC capital if I wanted it. Mm-hmm. Never went that route
mm-hmm.
At that point. But knew I had an issue,
mm-hmm.
you know. And what he had told me is, he's like, listen, this is not good. And if you want to be here in another year, he says, the first thing I do is get rid of that business.
Mm.
If you want any chance of fighting this.
Yeah.
And so.
Is that because of a stress level or just because of the amount of focus that you need to be able to apply both. Towards that?
Yeah, you got it. I mean, a lot of people don't understand that, but that is.
Well, I mean, when you own a business, I mean, you know, I mean, I get it, you know, the last 10, 12 years, that's it's you're never off. And my wife, you know, before my wife opened her business, which I was sharing with you a little bit before the show, what her business is, you know, 2.5-3 years ago when she was just, you know, an associate, I say just an associate, not downplaying associate dentist, but when she was an associate, not an owner, I'd come home and like, she wouldn't understand sometimes the mood I was in. Right. And I'm pretty much like water off my back. Like I don't let a lot of that stuff get to me usually, but obviously we all have our time. And it's funny though, because now she completely understands because she's been doing it for 3 years and it's like, you're never off.
Yeah.
And so it's a combination of, you know, I completely get where he's coming from. You had to be able, that had to be your focus. And your body probably didn't need the extra stress right. in order to beat it.
Yeah, and even on your good days, right, it's still taking focus.
Oh, for sure.
Right,
and it's still taking focus and it's still taking energy, stress, you know, all of it. You know, even to the toughest people, it does that.
Right. And so his, much like you said, the model is focus everything on fighting mm-hmm. and rebalancing. And so a lot of
stuff. So he was really getting your mentality right, too.
Yeah, and the cool thing is you know, he's a Christian, so, you know, he's also sharing the word with you, pointing things out. And I think when you start going through that, for me, number one, you had a journey of when I got the diagnosis, got in that vehicle. For me, I wasn't sad. I had some good peace. What made me sad was when I began to think about the people around me.
Mm-hmm.
Like, Quest was going to go on without me. I knew that. My family would eventually go on without me. I would believe that. But what I was worried about was all the people that didn't know Christ, who didn't know Jesus as Lord and Savior. So I think that's what started making me sad. And that's where I was like, God, I don't want to be done. But if all I got is a year, I want to go down swinging.
Mm-hmm.
I want to go down not just fighting cancer, but I want to fight for people's eternal life.
Diagnosed, was there a what stage was it at? Were you given a stage?
Well, gave me a year to live.
Oh, you gave me a year.
Yeah, we always say 4+.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Like, and so we.
And went, I mean, what's the percentage of people that beat stage 4 colon?
Here's number one. I don't believe whatever statistics they have out there, and I'll probably get ridiculed for this, but since being on tour, I cannot tell you the number of people I've met who have had colon cancer beating it. Both holistically, mm-hmm. naturally, and modern medicine-wise. I think the odds...
No matter what their stage has been.
Yeah, no matter what their stage has been. It's been tremendous, the amount of people I've met that have done that. So I don't buy all the statistics, and I think part of it is there's a lot of people that get that diagnosis and never return back to a doctor.
Yeah. I talk about that all the time, though, too, of I don't know if I've talked about much on the podcast, but there's a lot of statistics that I no matter what it is, it doesn't matter if it's medical. It's like we're going through the whole COVID thing. I'm like, this is bullshit. Right? Right. I don't believe a lot. You know, like I don't like. I mean, I you know the numbers and how they're skewing in and how you know they were was it well did they die from COVID or with COVID? You know, right. There's a difference and you know all that stuff. But it's the same thing. I've always been the same way, even in my business.
Yeah.
Because someone can make a stat kind of lean however they want to make it lean. And so like unless you see other stats or other supporting documents with that, I have a hard time believing that some of those
statistics.
And I
had someone say it to me one time, like, do you know the odds of both of these? And that's the problem is the first thing cancer will steal from you is hope.
Mm-hmm.
That is the very, that's the biggest thing it steals from you is hope. And it was part of the reason why I didn't want to do the documentary. I didn't want to be the poster child on cancer.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing I've been really convicted of lately is over the course of even this year, 110 cities, the number of people who have come from far places, Pikes Peak, we had people coming from, we had a guy coming from Norway, Sweden, Spain, him and his wife, because they had cancer, saw our story, and they wanted to meet us and see the race. And now
they were coming from all over the place to Pikes Peak to watch the race. Gotcha.
Just to get encouragement. You know, like, who's this guy with cancer? You know, and what I've learned in all of it is that's what it does to most of these people.
Mm-hmm.
Is it? And that is where I'm super fortunate is I found hope years before when I was super hopeless. I mean, you're talking to a guy as a kid that wanted to constantly commit suicide, who never felt like he measured up. I don't want people to feel that way, but cancer steals hope. And I think that's honestly what defeats people.
Well, you go
people.
From a background of like basically homeless, like in your documentary, right? I mean, that puts you in a dark place. And you talk about being an atheist when you're in college and question all that. What kind of made you obviously the documentary touches on a little bit, but what was kind of some of those final pushes that made you become an atheist for a little while there when you're in your younger years during college?
I think just you showing up on campus, I saw all these different dynamics, right? All these different religions. And yet I just felt like they were hypocrites.
Yeah.
You know, and in college, I don't think you always meet the finest crops of everything. You know, that's, I'm just gonna be honest. I certainly wasn't one of them, but I was not a fine human being at all. And I'm still not, but.
Well, they could be fine. They're just learning crops.
Right, yeah.
They're learning. going through first time life experiences.
But I think what really pushed me into it is I didn't see God anything. Like I was talking about this, like there were people I met along the way, you know, like I even think about like Joel's family, like his sister drove me nuts because she was always super nice to me.
Mm-hmm.
And her and I got along really good and she could sing like the Dickens, but his whole family's talented. They all suck. But I don't think there's anything they don't touch that turns to gold, but you know, they were super talented, but nice. And I knew those things, but I always looked at like, they all seem like they got it together.
Yeah.
All these other people, and so I think some of it came from anger, but when you don't see the presence of God in your life, it's probably because you're not looking in the right way, right? And I look back now, God was so much in my life and so much. I mean, when I was born of a twin. The doctors told my parents, like, we don't have the equipment to help your son. He's going to die. He just might not get detached. Just leave him be.
Mm.
And you don't tell a Sicilian woman and a dad who's bullheaded what to do, you know, they're going to see otherwise. And thank God. But, you know, he worked. But that was kind of what pushed me into atheism. And then I was like, well, I'm going to prove all these intellects wrong. Like how stupid it is for them to believe to any of these religions. And so I just took the major four and started going through them, really five. And those were really easy
You went through them, what were you doing going through them?
Archaeologically, historically, preservation, and prudence.
Mm.
And so, and it's really interesting.
On the internet or going to the library?
I'm old. So there was no internet.
Going to the library?
Going to the library, microfiches. The library was really good. You could ask for books from other libraries. So like I was getting stuff from the Smithsonian Institute. I was getting
stuff. In college?
Yeah. From Israel. I mean, it took like 3 months to get it, but I got a book from Israel that I needed.
So you went to the ends of the earth to.
Yeah. And it,
try
and,
to.
I mean. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm not a smart dude, right? So I needed a lot of like, I couldn't put things together real well, right?
Uh-huh.
And so just started researching and you know, Islam and Hindu and Buddhism and all that. Very interesting, right? They pivot on one person. There's not correlating documents. They don't allow forensics evidence. And all of a sudden you get – so those were pretty quickly to disprove, right? And then you get to Christianity, which I thought would be the easiest. Mm. And what you find is nothing what the world tells you. I mean, they have opened themselves up forensically, historically, preservation. They've been transparent. They don't hold a deity. It's the only religion that really does teach tolerance. And what I mean by that is we're the only religion that says, okay, you can have a new day and you could be a new creation every day. Mm-hmm. No other religion preaches that, right? It's always about making oneself or my God push things, right? It's also the only one where free will really is the center of it all.
Right.
Right? And then we begin to look at it. Like just for instance, the New Testament alone, we have 2.6 to 2.8 million documents that are written of the New Testament. That's more than any historical book or anything mm-hmm. else we have. By like 600 to 1.
Yeah.
You begin to look at not only that, but the life of Jesus Christ. We have more secular accounts than we do non-secular accounts of him being alive after he died, mm-hmm. of people seeing him after that. Book of Isaiah, right? Everybody thought it was so accurate, the prophecies in it, that everybody thought it was wrote after Jesus had lived. And then we find the Dead Sea Scrolls, where we're learning 400 to 700 years before Jesus even showed up on the scene, this thing told everything about Jesus, mm-hmm. and it was all right. Mm-hmm. And so you look at these things, it's the only book of prophecy anywhere that has 100% truth rate.
Yeah.
You know, Nostradamus, who we hold.
So this is not touching the documentary, how far, how deep you went to
oh, yeah.
prove it. Like you were saying there that you went to prove it wrong. Man, like I'm glad I asked that question because that puts into context how much time have you spent doing this?
It was a lot. So up until the time I was in the wheelchair, I only slept 2 hours a night. That was it. From the time I was about 15, 16, maybe even 10, that's all I slept. Hmm. And I loved it. Yeah. I love to work. I'm a workaholic, number mm-hmm. one. But I just, and so not only in college, so my first semester in college, I almost flunked out. I got like, I think it was a 1.3. That winter, I lied my way into an engineering job.
That's another question is what's the lie? So, this was also covered in the documentary. I'm like, man, what lie did you tell? There's so much in the documentary. That's why I'm like, I had to watch it twice.
This was before Jesus, okay? I'm just going to say
that. Well, every day is a new day.
It is. It is. And I was at Century Foods in Broadhead, and I knew the plant manager, wonderful guy. His name was El Schneider. And
this was like
my freshman year.
Freshman year of college. Okay.
Just got done with the first semester. Like literally, I saw him a day after I found out how horrible I did.
Okay.
And I was so ashamed because I knew Al growing up. He was a cool guy and he taught me a lot. And when he asked me how college is going, I'm like, great, you know, it's going really good. And he's like, oh, and he started talking about it. And I was like, I picked engineering. This is the honest God's truth because I had the word engine in it. I was so angry when I showed up at college and they're like, I'm like, where do we get to play at the engine? He's like, what are you talking about? I'm like, engineering. He's like, you don't know what engineering is? I'm like, no. I mean, Danielle knows it was not on my radar to go to college. I literally picked a college and applied like a month before Platteville started. So, and I'm telling him, oh, I'm doing great. And he's like, hey, we've got this internship. So because I knew him, I got to skip a whole portion of it. So when I went in, I had an interview with a gentleman named Bill Weichman. And he interviewed me and they had a small little test. Well, I did great on both because it was really just a hands-on kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And they hired me. For an internship. And so because I lied about all that stuff, here I am in the internship.
Well, now, I mean, he asked you how it was college. He didn't specifically say, hey, what's your GPA?
Anyways.
maybe he did.
Okay. I'm not answering that one. Anyways, I it's not my proudest moment, but I will tell you what a blessing. And so I drove 60 miles each way to school. And, you know, I lived in Platteville and I drove to work and Ed Deneen, who was a registrar there second semester, he really helped me out, got my schedule where I could really make it easy, make an internship.
So this internship kind of turned it around as far as school then too?
It did.
You decided to get it right?
Yeah, so a week after I got hired, school starting, I had to go in and because I was on academic warning, I had to pay the whole semester right now. Mm-hmm. And I had Looney Tune checks. I won't forget this. And I went to give it to the lady, and she was trying to pull it out of my hand. She's like, are you okay? I said, I'm afraid I'm making a mistake. I don't think I'm smart enough for this. And so we talked, and she says, have you ever studied in your life? I'm like, no. I wasn't going to plan to come to college. She's like, why don't you take this course? She says, it's 5 days. Teach you how to take notes. Hmm. So I got this engineering job, took this class, and it changed everything.
You still take notes the way they taught you there?
Yep.
Still do today?
Still do.
Interesting.
Still do.
Yeah.
It's a great way. And so all that kind of came together. I'm studying these religions, trying to prove them all wrong. After about a year, well, the first ones were like 6 months. That's all it took. Those weren't hard. The more I went into Christianity, I'm going to be honest, I got more mad. Hmm. I was angry. There was a common thread here the whole time. Don Thayer, God bless him. If I was him, I would have buried me. I would have killed me. I dated his daughter on and off, but he never stopped loving me and guiding me. And even in my atheistic age where I'd have harsh questions for him, he was just patient. And I can remember he was often an antagonist in my mind. Like he was a man who lived a Christian life and was just a man who you could tell loved people, but yeah. He was stern and honest. And, you know, so while I'm going through that, I've got that dichotomy kind of antagonizing at me. So I'm just getting more and more mad. And I would say 6 months before I gave my life to Christ, before I had that revelation moment, like what you see in the video, I could tell you how to get to heaven. It's pretty easy. You know, it's not by works, but by faith alone, faith in Jesus Christ. But I wouldn't do it. Hmm. I wouldn't do it. You know, that's the bad thing. Wouldn't do it
mean have faith?
I just didn't want to give my life to Christ. Hmm. You know, I saw what it did to all the disciples. You know, I remember how I was studying this. They all died except for one being a martyr. Mm-hmm. Paul was shipwrecked and beaten. Peter was beaten and stuff. You know, you have all these things And I really felt like as I was so miserable, I was so hopeless. And I was just, you know, I had everything at this point, just bought a brand new bright yellow Ford Ranger. That's when you've arrived, bro. When you can buy one of those. I had a girl I was dating. I had this great job, was doing great in school. But yeah, I was miserable. And it was so hard because everybody says, look how successful you are. Look at how good you're doing. Mm-hmm. Oh, you're amazing. You're awesome. And you're like, nothing I ever heard growing up. Some of these people were the very people that made my life miserable, telling me how stupid I was and what a waste of space I was. So it was a very, almost like torturous thing. And I just was afraid that the hopelessness I felt would become so much worse because then I had no identity. Because mm-hmm. The only thing I did have to grab on was what I had in success, right? But finally one night at work, you know, God just spoke to me out of love and mercy. And I, to this day, I'll tell you, I felt like I heard it audibly that he just told me, you know, open up this big preheater. You know, when you open the oven and it like hits you in the face, mm-hmm. That's what it was like. And he just said, this is nothing compared to the hell you'll face if you don't turn to the truth, you know. Hmm.
That's crazy.
And so I hit my knees in the middle of this forklift aisle in the middle of the night at Woodbridge in Broadway, Wisconsin. Hmm. And I gave my life to Christ in between my sophomore and junior year in college. In fact, it was the beginning of June. And I don't know that I stood up feeling a lot different. I was really grieved in that moment I was very faced with all that had separated me from God, all the sins I had. But I can't say I got up and felt like miraculously different. But 3 days later I did, because I woke up one morning and I was like, what's that I feel? I didn't feel so weird. And then I can remember that night I was lying awake, and normally I'd lie awake at night and I'd feel so empty. Like literally I felt like wind was blowing through me every night. My hardest time going to bed was just trying to fight off hopelessness. Hmm. And then that night I didn't have that feeling. Like I was looking back at the day with like, that was a good day. Why was it a good day? And the first thing that popped in my mind, well, I read this in Matthew 6:33, and to this day, it's my favorite verse. Seek first his kingdom and his righteousness, and all will be added onto you. And do not worry about tomorrow, for today has enough troubles of its own. Hmm. And I was like, that made it a good day. And then I realized the standard had changed. The world was telling me this measurement tool of my worth, and here was God telling me what I was. And that's where I really felt hope flip. Hmm. And that's where I found hope was in Jesus. And so from then it was, I felt like my work got a lot better. I felt like everything got a lot better. Still, I still was a butthole. I mean, that took a long time. I'm being honest, to knock that off. I think, you know,
we all are. You still are, probably.
Yeah, I am. I don't mean to be, but you know, you try. But I think that was a pivotal moment for me, and then things started changing. And then I think when you change in that manner, people begin to. Some people that saw potential in you now can speak to you differently, and speak into you differently. And on top of that, you don't carry the weight of the world anymore. Or at least shouldn't. Now I struggle with that in my life, you know, still. But I think that was a moment for me where, like, and that is when I got the cancer diagnosis. Why that last year was so important, because I'm like, if I'm gonna die, I want no one to feel hopeless. I don't want anybody to feel the way I did.
Yeah, that's a lot right there.
Sorry,
No, you're good. When so you graduated in what year of college? I'm just trying to put timelines.
We keep talking about this.
So. Well, because I'm trying to just like timeline. Because right there, what you talked about, okay, I was sophomore, junior year, this whole experience when the heat wave hits me at work, I fall to my knees. Four nights after that is when you look back, it's a good day. And then you just kind of mentioned all the way up to right before you got cancer.
Yeah.
So is that like a 10 year? That's the only reason I'm just trying to think, okay, how much?
Okay, I get what you're saying.
20 years there? 20 years. 20 years in between there?
Big gap. Right?
So that's why, okay. So then.
And there's a lot to happen in that 20 years.
For sure. For sure. Yeah. No, I just was trying to get some context there. Man, that right there is just like a great story. Your story is like just phenomenal.
Well, I don't know that. You know, that's what's funny.
It is a phenomenal story.
Well, I appreciate that.
The documentary could be more than one 20-minute.
Well, they were going to make it an hour and a half. Joel
that's
knows
right.
this.
Yeah, I mean, yeah.
And the reason why they stuck to 23 minutes is we felt like you could go speak somewhere.
Right, for sure, yeah.
And still show the film.
Yeah.
Because it was a big debate that got done. They're like, man, maybe we should make this an hour and a half. So they all prayed about it, and they came back at this 23-minute mark. And I will say, like, I'm glad it was an hour and a half just because I don't know that I could put up with me. I've only watched the film twice.
Yeah.
I can't watch it.
Yeah.
I am an emotional wreck, and it's not in a bad way.
You're emotional just, in it.
Oh, yeah, it was tough.
You're emotional, yeah.
What's interesting is in the whole process, there are so many things I never told people that they asked me. Things that I guess I was ashamed of because I didn't want people to look at me differently or whatever. But after the film, you start realizing, like, that's a part of my story. And people went through that. And I don't think my story's special. I really don't. But I think that's why so many people relate to it, because we all have had people that are affected by cancer. We've all had goals and accomplishments we've wanted to see come true, and some of them don't come true, and some of them do. And we all have a journey that is so much like that, right, where we battle these things. We battle, you know, do we control it or does God control it? Do we submit it or do we commit it? You know, which one is it? And we have all these things. And I think that's why it's so relatable. I told a friend of mine when it came out, I'm like, I just don't get this. Why we're getting so much traction with these? Like, because it's everybody's story. And I've really come to understand that.
When you say you've gotten so much traction with the documentary, what's some of the things that have come from the documentary?
A lot of speaking. So, like, you know, 110 cities. I mean, we try to
110 cities since when? You've been doing this for 2 years?
A year of November.
A year, and you've been 110 cities speaking.
110 cities, yeah. Which I don't feel like it's been that much. I only try to tour maybe 2 weeks out of the month. Uh-huh. But sometimes you'll go from city to city to city. Like this last tour, I was in 5 states, spoke, I think, 14 times.
Yeah.
So, like, just 2 weeks, there's 14. So it can add up pretty quick. You know, we've seen 2,000 people who've come to know Christ. We've seen nearly 200 people who show up at these events and say, I was going to commit suicide today. And I could tell you stories, man, that is one thing, is to see God. Number one, God used someone like me, which I don't understand, and I'm not perfect. But to see him use me in any way. But that is where, like, I never used to talk about the suicide I had. I mean, there was I don't know if you remember the race I brought in. When you go down by the old channel, there was a big tree there. I can't tell you the number of times I hooked a rope to it and tied to it and put the noose around my neck. And you know what's really funny is the only reason I couldn't do it was I'd be thinking, like, oh, I can't leave that broken car for my dad and mom. I always, and I think that's where God used cars in my life.
Yeah,
like I didn't realize it, but there I was. Like I can remember one time just, I wanted to so be done with life. And I had this 1976 Chevy Malibu. Yes, I owned some Chevys in my life. And it wasn't done. And I just got done. There was oil all over the driveway. I mean, and I was like, oh, I can't leave that for mom and dad. And I look back and I'm like, I didn't know God. Mm-hmm. I didn't know his voice. But God was still working in all these things. Like he's still working, even though I don't see it. And he worked them all for the good. And so that was something in this journey I didn't talk about much until the film. And then since the film. And then I've realized how much that resonates with people and how you can help people. I mean, I'll give you an example if you're all right.
Yeah, for sure.
About some stories.
Absolutely.
One of the very first events I did, I don't remember what state I was in, got done speaking. What I always try to do when I speak is I hang out and we'll pray for people, talk with people. I did not expect that. I always thought, like, the first time I ever really we did this pre-speaking thing in Colorado at Lehigh. And I got done speaking, picked up my water bottle, turned around, and JP's like, where are you going? I'm like, I'm done speaking. He's like, no, turn around. And I looked, and there were all these kids lined up, these high schoolers. And they told me, I was there for 2.5 hours. And that's where I started realizing, like, okay, something's up. So we did a launch event.
Mm-hmm.
Sometime in that first month or two of the tour, got done speaking at this event, talking with people. And there was a girl kind of hanging out in a chair for a while. And everybody was gone, and the principal was looking at me, and he's just like, because I said, you know, and he's like, and so she got up, and she got about as far as Joel is from us, and she started to cry, just bawling. And I just held up my arms, and I kind of gave her a hug, and I said, you know, what's going on? And she's like, I came to school this day. She says, this is my second day of school, and I came here to clean up my locker. Mm. And I said, okay, well, were you going to quit school? And she's like, no, I was going home to kill myself. And I looked up, and there was a little poster on the door that said Chasing Hope. And I thought, man, hope. And she thought, I'll hang out at school today and see what happens.
Hmm.
Come find out this girl had been suffering for 2 years wanting to kill herself because 2 years before this, her mom brought her up to a six-story building, said, I have something to tell you. Looks her in the eyes and says, I don't want you as a daughter anymore, and shoved her off the building.
Hmm.
And she lived.
Hmm. Whoa.
And this girl was like, you know, she had great foster parents. She told me they're great foster parents, but she says, I didn't know someone loved me enough like Jesus does until you told me. And so she had never really understood that, like, because I talk a lot about, like, God don't make mistakes. He don't, you know, and he's the creator of the universe, yet he takes time to knit us all together in the womb. Think about that. At the point of conception, there is an electrical and light that's emitted that we can't even measure how much energy is so much energy. That creator is knitting us together for us, and he's the great designer. He knows, much like you, like this building, right? You know what you needed it to look like to fit the call of this building.
Yeah.
God knows what our calling and purpose is
and
his plan is. And if we don't know him, we don't know his love, we're never going to accomplish that.
Mm-hmm.
And that just resounded with her. And that story is not uncommon. I mean, they were asking for quotes from the year, like mail, and we get mail and DMs and all this other stuff. Another one was a lady in Indiana. I won't forget this. She came and afterwards we're out there talking to people. The venue wasn't as big as they thought it would be. I don't care. I'll go for one person just as long as if they hear what they need to hear. And this lady came up, she's crying. My wife and I talked to her and she stared a lot with us. But what had happened is she doesn't know God, wasn't religious, nothing. She came to school to drop her son's bag off. And she dropped the bag off at the office for her son. And she was walking out the doors and she saw the poster.
Popped her head in.
And she thought, it was later that day, but she thought about it. She's like, Chasing Hope. And it was antagonizing her. And she says, what you don't understand is I went to school to give him that bag because next to me was a gun and pills in my car, and I was going to kill myself. And she said something antagonized me about chasing hope. Like, what hope? And she's like, I don't even know what that is. I don't even know what hope is. And she said it just, she said she sat in that car. She waited in that car for 8 hours. And then came to the venue.
Well, the timing for these people, obviously, is, it's unexplainable.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, nobody can explain that.
And that's all God. That's not me. This is not me at all.
The speaking you do, the speaking events, engagements, are they, is it other people that you go speak with? Is it just you? I'm just trying to think of what the typical crowd is or how
that's varied.
Okay. So that's, it can be like high schools and a high school.
Middle schools, high schools, colleges, universities, business events, conferences, camps, churches, youth groups, retreats. I've spoken at all.
So when they call you, are they looking for a certain message each time and you have a kind of a packed thing, or is it, are you kind of customizing for them, or you're just speaking what's on your heart in that moment?
I'll just tell you right now, bro. I've been told by a very well-known school in the nation who I've spoke at, they've had John Maxwell and everybody else. And I asked him, I said, why are you guys having me back? He's like, well, you're not real polished. And I'm like, I agree. And he says, but you connect, yeah, and you love people. And he says, and you're genuine. And he says, and we like the fact you're not polished. I don't have a canned message, but I do find that there's like 8 different themes that tend to pop up.
Yeah.
And it depends if I'm in a business setting, you know, talking to business groups or whatever it may be.
So you're rolling in and it's like, okay, I'm talking to a business today. These are maybe some of the things. They're not necessarily giving you bullet points on what they're really, like, what they're really wanting to get. A conference
sometimes will be like, hey, here's our theme.
Got it.
You know, or a church might. And that's about it. I mean, most of them are open. And I always pray. I never want to just rely on a canned message. So I always pray, like, you know, Holy Spirit, what do you want me to say to these people? Like, what is it they need to hear?
These can't be public schools having you come and speak, right?
I've only had a few. Public schools are tricky.
Yeah.
But
which is too bad. I'm not, I mean, I would, it's, that's where, you should be. That's what, I mean, yeah. Man.
But we might have a chance in what school just legalized the Bible back in school?
Oh, I did hear about that.
The state. Yeah, there was a Oklahoma, state that did it. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I might be there.
Kansas, Oklahoma, right? Who knows? Yeah. Yeah. So a lot of private universities, a lot of private
and we're actually high looking schools. To do tours this next year. I don't know if I should say this or not, but we're going to, we're actually going to tour on public universities this year. Cool. That's what we're really, we've got a donor that's really, his heart is really like, hey, listen, if Turning Point can go, why can't this message go?
For sure.
You know? Yeah. And so we're trying to figure those venues out.
And this is like the time for it.
Yeah.
Right now, dude, because like everything that has shifted where like the three of us in our opinions over the last 4 or 5 or 6 years, like people, but now it's like, now people who maybe agreed with us that we didn't know agreed with us or something, right, they're like ready to come out and say, I'm with you.
And maybe who didn't agree 3 or 4 years
or
ago.
Or who didn't agree.
Yeah. And all of a sudden they have this like pivot moment.
They pivot. Yeah. I know a lot of people that just, you know, this year they didn't vote at all, but historically like would have just done anyone but Trump and you know, it's whatever. And they just chose not to, which again, whatever, but it's like a severe, like I would have never guessed that 4 or 5 years ago from that person.
I just hope we don't squander it, whatever this looks like. And no matter what, my king is still on the throne. But I'm excited about what this new administration is bringing.
Yeah,
I'm excited about the openness. I do feel like there's an openness to the gospel. Mm-hmm. And I think, like, why wouldn't there be? You know, everybody wants to cast off Christianity as like this, oh, you guys are homophobic, you know, transphobic, whatever. You guys realize we're the only religion that says no matter what your choices are, we're still to love you?
Mm-hmm.
Did you know that?
Right.
You know, like, okay, you know, yeah, whatever you may think, the truth is we stand for love.
Yeah.
You know, and we got to remember, like, there's this whole thing. But you look at historically, and I am a statistics guy, but I'm much like you. I doubt everything.
I'm a statistics guy, but I question every single one. It's not...
I got to see a lot of correlation.
Yeah.
I can't.
I don't bury my head in the sand. I just question every single one that I see.
And I think that's fair, bro.
Yeah.
But when you look at the nation, across the nation where schools have rapidly declined, it almost directly correlates to the Christian influence in it.
Mm-hmm.
Everywhere.
When they've declined from a matter of, you talk about population, school, like.
Let's first talk. So there's three metrics I use for that. One is health, emotional health of people going there.
And you're talking universities or?
I'm talking public school system.
Public school system.
100%.
Okay.
Okay. And that's from middle school. Because elementary statistics are stuff because they protect them pretty well. High school and middle school are a little bit better. Universities are definitely best. But all three have the same trend. So when we talk about emotional health, okay, that is people who are seeking psychotherapists or psychologists are on some type of drug, psychodrug. And then we look at attempts of suicide and we look at dropout rate, right? Because those are all have to do with mental health, right?
Sure.
It's almost directly correlated. We saw a big decline within the first 5 years of the United States' rampant acceptance of separate church from state, which is not how it's meant to be, but we've played it that way, where we've taken the Bible and stuff out of it. What's funny is when you start to look at those areas, like there's a place in Nebraska, I won't name where it's at so it doesn't get hate. They've been one of the sheltered ones where they've refused to go off that. But when you look at them, they're one of the healthiest school districts in the nation. And what we've seen is now we've seen this new influx, especially with the homeschool movement and things like that. There's a lady who down south, she started her home. She was going to do homeschooling. She thought, well, I should start a school, offer something different. These kids only get 2 hours instruction a day. The rest of the time, they're in the Word. They're learning entrepreneurial skills.
Yeah.
They just went through an Airbnb chapter, like I've out of Bible.
Yeah, I know who you're talking about. Yeah,
incredible things, right? And but she got sued and everything else. Guess what? All the test scores came back. No other school scored higher than her school.
Yeah,
and then they accused her of cheating. They went through everything. No, they didn't. It's always that kind of mentality. So I think with this new administration, I hope we see some things change.
I do too, man.
You know, that. Listen, I've been in schools, public and private. I'm telling you, we need school reform. And even if I take my Christian beliefs and views out of it, let's take that out of it. The school's broken.
It's because it's been the same for what else has been the same since forever? I mean, it's Rockefeller that put this stuff in, you know?
Right.
I mean, to train to so he could get more employees, right?
And that's
for
it.
Standard Oil and, you know.
And even look at it. The federal government's school administration, right? That stepped in ever since then. We've just been on the decline. Our school education has not gotten any better since the federal government got involved.
Mm-hmm.
It's gone the opposite. But we don't talk about that.
But they are talking about getting it out of the federal government.
Yeah.
That's one of the big things about getting it out. And the crazy thing that just blows my mind, and even with the abortion stuff, right? So everyone's like, oh, and I know, again, so many people that we're close to, and you see what they're posting, and it's like the things that they said about, you know, Trump coming into office, like, well, that's not what he's saying about abortion. No. He's sending it back to the states.
Right.
And he's sending it back to the states. So the states, the local, you can decide locally what you're going to do, right? And so it's not the federal government shoving it down people's throats. And ideally, like the federal government shouldn't have any, like, no power.
No, it was never intended to have the power.
No, never, never. And that's just how it ended up happening.
It was more meant to be a unification thing, right? And so everywhere I see that they get involved, it makes things more difficult, right?
Yeah.
And it's a big waste. And, you know, I'm all about efficiency. I can't wait to see what happens when we start going through and seeing efficiency. There's a lot of things that, and I get fear, you know, like you said, some of the posts about fear, about, you know, women's health and everything like that. Number one is there's no state that denies an interstate health procedure.
Right.
So we're, you know, number one, let's talk facts. But I think if we continue, fear has gotten us to this point. But, you know, previous to this year, fear's got us to this point. That's been what's pushed all along, right? Fear that we're going to lose something, fear that we're going to have something, fear that we're missing out on something. Discontentment is a really funny thing.
Mm-hmm.
And when you can feed fear in with that, That's a real manipulative tool. But, you know, you've got MSNBC, right? Like, why is it everybody thinks that they were the tower of all this information when now all of a sudden we're seeing all their viewer content? 38,000 people watching Maddow?
Right.
Why does she have such a big voice? You know, and that would have never came out had it not gone up for sale.
Right.
But I think just the sale in itself shows they'll sell to anybody. So what do they really stand for? And the other thing that's happened is we've learned independent media is the best way to go.
Mm-hmm.
Where everybody thought it had no power, podcasters, things like this, where we're You don't have to agree with
it's
us.
It's so transitional too, because even look at, you know, the best of the best with Joe Rogan, right? I mean, how much his mindset has evolved around so much of this, and like, and what even what they say about Christianity with what Elon and what them, they all go back to the principles. You can't argue with the principles of Christianity,
right?
And you can't. What you know? Nobody really can. If you if you remove, like you said, if you removed Christ from it, if you remove the Bible, and if you just took these principles, everyone would be like, oh yeah. Oh yeah,
I'll sign up. Oh for
yeah,
that.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah,
but then it's like now, it's, all right. Well, I'm super excited for the next few years. Yeah. I hope, like you said, I hope it's not squandered. I hope it's not wasted, because the next four could set up the whole entire next generation that completely pivots away from where we're at the last 16. You know.
Yeah, and so you know, along that vein is how do we? Just even us, right? In this circle here, how do we do what we can with what we have, right? And where do we move things along? And I was thinking about, you know, your business model, and you know, statistically we look at. So obviously, I learned a lot about VC when I got bought out, and I learned a lot about it the 3 years before I got bought out, just because of so many. So when you're down, like we were doing a lot in the Salinas Valley, which is next door to Silicon, they have a mentality over there where like VC money falls off the trees and hits you in the head because they're all so afraid to miss out on the Google. Great thing.
Yeah.
But statistically, when you look at like that VC money, it's 25% make it to the finish line, like even make it in business. Where if someone's self-starting, it's 50%, still not great, you know, but what's interesting is when you start looking at like places that are like, I'm going to propel something that makes a difference, all of a sudden those rates change. And it's really interesting, and you're probably wondering, well, where I'm going, like you look at what you've built and the journey you've gone on, right? Which is incredible, by the way.
Thank you.
And I'll be honest, I didn't know a whole lot about you until you contacted me. And then I think I've watched every Instagram, found every bit of a podcast I could.
Appreciate that.
But there was one thing that was really significant to me, which I think really just showed, you know, number one, your hard work and then you're driven.
Yeah.
You're obviously driven. God's given you a brain too, which if you want to lend some of it, I'd be great.
Well, I don't know, man. I'm not, like you said, I'm not the smartest stuff. Trust me, I'm not the smartest guy.
But all the thing, but all the things I saw in there, that revelation you had were like, we have enough tenants where it's as big as the town I grew up in.
Yeah.
And you said, and then I started to realize like before it was more about just giving them a place to live, where now it's about giving them an environment, giving them an experience, a place where if they're going to be here, let's make it the best we can for them.
Darn it, we're still so far away from that. But the thing
so
is,
what does
is
that
like,
mean to you? Like when you say we're so far away.
Yes. I think the first thing is, and my team knows this, is I'm never like satisfied. It's always, and I'm never like, hey, good job. Like it's bad. I'm always like, okay, next, like right away, next thing, right? So I'm hard on myself. I'm hard on what we do. You know, I hear like moving to this. So prior to us being in this office, I was, our office was down in Janesville. It was a lot smaller than this. I kind of got booted because we just didn't have enough room. And our conference room there got turned into like, there's four cubicles in there, whatever. And so we just needed more room. So we come to this office and, you know, we start changing how we're doing things. Like historically, property management has a property manager for every 100 to 200 units. We don't even have a property manager on staff anymore. We're changing, like we're centralizing a lot of things to try to provide better service for people, right? And so being in this office is one of the best things that's happened because I have my door open a lot. I can hear our centralized service team right here, a lot of the conversations, and I just like start cringing some days, right? Like what's, because like we're in the middle of this huge change, right? And I met with our executive team yesterday and I'm like, guys, by January 31, we need to wrap up like our playbooks for our different parts of our company, because right now not everyone is doing the same thing the same way, and you know, a vast majority of the people that we hire are not going to be superstars that can just figure it out. Will we find 5%, 10%, 15% of just superstars that are going to be able to do it? Yeah, but we're not. That's not. So we're trying to finish and wrap some of that stuff up to get there. But like, I guess that's a little bit where I'm coming from. Is like, no matter how good we do, I'm always going to be like, okay, how can we do better?
Yeah.
But, and I think we just have a long way to go. We have a long way to go to get there. But, you know, when I first started in, you know, again, 20, you know, graduate from school in 2012 and I'm doing direct sales, you know, just from like 2011, I started direct sales and I was like, how can I just get enough money to buy the first 4 unit? Right. So like that whole time, I'm really just trying to keep my own head above water. Mm. Right. And like you get the first building, still trying to keep my own head. And it's not that I'm trying to still, there's days I go all, you know, being an entrepreneur, investor, you know, whatever, there's days you go back to zero in your bank account because you're all in on something. Right. Yep. So there's still days I'm like, oh, like, you know, but, So, but what just kind of changed a little bit is, you know, when it got, I don't know if it's like more comfortable or whatever, maybe financially, that's when I'm like, okay, I need to like open my eyes a little bit because of like some of the comment, like the comments that we get like on our Google page, like they affect me sometimes.
Right.
Now, the negative people are always going to be louder than the people that are happy.
They have nothing better to
do. But like, I go look at them, I'm like, damn, that sucks. That sucks. Yeah. That person feels that way. And I'm not like, I don't feel bad for me or like, oh, pity me. Like, oh, why are they? I've come from their angle. I'm like, oh man, it sucks that they feel that way. To, you know, what did we must have been really bad to them or for them to perceive us or whatever. And that's where I'm like, what can we truly do better to make it an all around really good experience from the moment they call for the first time, you know, looking for an apartment to the application process. And like I said, we still got to fix a lot of things. But it's how can we again get the best experience all the way around the board. I mean, right. How can we get to, you know, we have a segment of our properties, about 450 units, about a quarter of our properties where, if a resident puts in a work order, 90, it depends on the week, 88 to 95% of the times over the last about 90 to 120 days, we've gotten, 88 to 92% of those work orders done in like 19 hours. Oh, wow. That's pretty fast turnaround, yeah. Right? So that's an impact to me because it's like, okay, they're not having to wait forever. Now, as we still push that through the rest of our portfolio, like there's times where it's like, man, why'd this one take 2 weeks? Mm-hmm. I get it. Sometimes we got to order apart or, you know, whatever. But like, that's just not acceptable. So it's stuff like that. And I always find that. And I always try to look at that. But it's like, how can we keep doing better? And, you know, there's been some comments that I'll post this stuff like, oh, you're starting to sound like a Democrat a little bit or like getting soft. I'm like, trust me, I'm not soft. Like I'm not my staff knows I'm not soft. It's just, but it's just like, how can it be better for everybody? I'm not saying we still want to make a profit. We're still going to buy these buildings that we buy. They're dilapidated. I mean, we buy stuff that the seller won't disclose to it. We bought 246 units last year up in La Crosse. Seller did not disclose that he'd gotten two notices from the city. 4 days after we closed, we got the third notice that said, if you don't fix the siding, the landscaping, there's like five issues on this thing, we're going to start fining you $1,000 a day. Like that's how bad it was. There was trees growing through the siding. It was ugly. So we went to the city, we said, hey, here's our CapEx plan. Here's just give us, you know, 6 months. You're going to notice a huge difference. They're like, okay, it's all good. So the properties we buy, we need in it. And then you get in those properties, right? You get the rents that they're, you know, for a two bedroom are still $700 a month. So it's stuck in like 2004, 2006, right? So what's going to naturally happen? That rent's going to double, mm-hmm. You know? And so it's those, you know, and so, well, I don't know the number. I mean, it could be 5%, 20% of the people we really, really piss off from that. Mm-hmm. You know, they get really mad. But it, some days it sounds like it's 90% because of how loud that they can be.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And I think I've started to take some of that stuff to heart from a standpoint of, again, not that it's going to make me quit on anything that I'm doing or I'm not so upset. Like, just like, okay, how can we try to make this whole entire process better? So like this last property we bought, we were out there the first day with coffee, like giving coffee out to people and trying to like give them treats and like, you know, like just trying to, okay, again, what can we do that's above and beyond?
Yeah.
And so every single deal that we buy, we're trying to do stuff like that. That's like, okay, what's the next step? What's the next step? What can we do better? Like, how can we be better here?
That's fair. I think, you know, we were known in our company about being the most innovative. Like, mm-hmm. Why were you beaten? We tried to be 2 years ahead of the competition to 5 years. And I think even now, like when I sold, there's been no evolution of that really. And they're still ahead on technology. But one of the things I'd always ask people is, what keeps you awake at night? Like working here, what keeps you awake at night? What's your biggest headache? And the second thing is, all right, how can we meet that headache? Mm-hmm. What can we do? The other thing is, early on in my business, if you want a course on how to do everything wrong in business, I could help you.
Yeah.
Yeah. I never wanted to be an entrepreneur. I started my business in an 8x10 tin shed behind my mobile home.
Was it, when did you start your business?
2001, I think it was. All right. 2000, right before 9/11. Yeah.
And you left a W-2 job to start that business?
No, it was a side hustle at that point. I didn't go full-time until 2003.
So you're working a W-2 job. What was your job?
I was working at Woodbridge, and they were awesome about it. They're like, hey.
Oh, so your internship turned into a full-time gig.
I went
gig.
To a full-time job. So Woodbridge, it was awesome. I was a plant engineer. I was a plant manager. I was a head of research and development. I
did it all.
They were great.
What a great experience.
Oh, they were awesome.
Because now, like when you go start your business, that's similar to me too, because like I did everything in our company. I've done every role here. I've answered the phones. I've done a showing. I've done a
So
that's basically what you did engineering-wise, right? You pretty much did everything that you could do at that company,
and
you probably learned a lot of different things.
I did, and they were great, man. They Bill Weichman, my first boss, actually was the first president I ever hired for Quest.
Really?
Yeah, when I started thinking about someone who, when we started the culture system, someone who I felt like along the way that really embraced that was Bill. And so I called him out of the blue. I hadn't talked to him in years. And said, hey, Bill, and brought him in, and he took over. He did a wonderful job being the president of the company. But yeah, I mean, they... But what I learned when I started that business is we struggled a lot. Like I went to banks and they're like, well, that robots are toys or they're terminated. We're not going to, you know, so I had nothing. I had nothing. I cashed out my 401k to start this business. My wife had a full-time job. So we decided, we prayed. I was making custom choppers and robots. And we prayed about what should we do here? And we felt like robots was it. So I quit my job, went full-time in robotics, no business plan. And, 3 weeks later, Mary got laid off.
No.
And so it was.
What were you thinking there? Were you think? Did you have any thought at all?
What were you thinking there? I wasn't. That's the problem. Well,
No. In that moment, you're 3 weeks in, she gets laid off. In that moment, what were you thinking as far as, did you have any thoughts of going back to your W-2?
No.
Not at all. You're fully committed.
Because I felt like we heard from God to do this.
Okay.
So like now it was, okay, what does faith look like? So I went out, and for the first 2 years, I think I saw my wife and kids 3 weekends.
Yeah.
I just kept going until I found work. I literally drove.
People don't believe me when I say I went to, I can count on one hand how many parties I went to from 2012 to 2018.
See?
And people are like, oh, I'm like, I'm not, it's not a, I'm not just, so I can, I completely get it.
Yeah. And so when you do that, so there were some dichotomies there, right? I was doing that. 9/11 was still felt. And then we hit the merger acquisition. Remember, dot-coms busted, and all of a sudden VCs were looking for merger acquisitions. Well, what happened is you had that and SAP at the same time. So I was doing, I mean, it was nothing for me to put down 100, 120 hours a week. No lie. No one's paying me.
You got 160 hours or so in a week, right? 169, something like that. You got 40, that's a lot of hours.
Yeah. And so, but here we are. They're not paying because they're caught up in merger acquisition land back then. And then SAP first came out, and that was a nightmare. And so I wasn't getting paid. I went almost 400 days without paycheck. And you want to, like, anything consistent, like one small customer might send us something to buy us enough food.
And that's what I was just going to ask. So if someone's just listening, like, want to start their own business, what did you already have some savings saved up from the previous job?
No, I cashed out my 401k.
You cashed it all out, put it all into the company. So then at that point, when that check went into the company to start up, you had nothing. You had basically zero in the bank account.
Zero.
Had zero in the bank account.
And I'll tell you this much, for those who want to start out business, here we are a year later. It wasn't because I wasn't working. Places weren't paying. I was selling things. I was doing side jobs. I was fixing cars just to get money to put food on the table. But there was a time where all of a sudden no one paid. It was right before Christmas. Well, you know why. Everybody's like, well, I can let that guy go fixing my car. And we had nothing. And I opened up. It was the second oldest mobile home in Broadhead. I love that mobile home. I miss it. And it was old. It was our home. I opened up the fridge. We had about a half a quart of half and half. We had in the freezer 2 pounds of venison, and Mary hates venison. And we had 2 boxes of macaroni and cheese. And I'm sitting there going,
that's to feed how many of you at that point?
There was 4 of us, and one was a baby, real little baby. And I was broken. But I just knew God had put us on this plan, and I was, the last bit of money we gave away. like a week before this, because I thought I was going to get paid from these little jobs, and someone had a need in our church, and I felt like I was supposed to get money for that. That night, the neighbor lady, who we never talked to, she was cranky. Hopefully she'll never see this. She comes over with a pan of lasagna. And she's like, I don't know why, but I made two pans of lasagna. Would you guys want one? And I'm like, yes. And so that lasagna got out of there. And then I wake up the next morning, and on my windshield wiper is a gas card to Stop and Go. Just small things like that got us through. And me and Mary sometimes didn't eat because we wanted to make sure the kids would have enough food just in case. My wife stuck through that. My wife, she's an amazing woman.
Yeah.
But I think you learn in that we always want to, and especially nowadays with social media and everything, we want to glamorize entrepreneurship. But like you said, there's sacrifices to it.
Sure.
What I won't do is coach. I do a lot of business coaching, not as much as I used to because of the tour. But when I business coach, there's all different. I've business coach companies that have 22,000 employees to 5 employees.
Yeah.
But I won't sit with someone who says, well, why are you getting into business? I want money. I want to make money.
Mm-hmm.
Because the truth of the matter is that money will dry up at one point. Your account will go down to zero when you're growing or you're taking a risk that you have to run on something else.
Yeah.
That's just the truth, whether it's passion, whether it's a calling or whatever. And what happens is in those moments, you're hungry. And hungry will make you do one of three things. It'll make you, number one, wallow in self-pity and give up. Number two, test your morals. It'll either make you crooked or it'll make you solidified in your morals. And number three, hungry will make you driven.
100%.
One of those, or maybe even two of those, right?
Sometimes it's the best feeling in the world, to be honest.
I would agree.
Because I was like, I got no option. I got to go, this is what I got to go do today.
Yeah.
You know, like I got to go grind.
And we're risk takers.
Yeah.
You know, but I've always felt like I'm calculated risk.
Yeah, 100%.
And I think for some people it's hard, you know, to look at it, but it's also been a blessing on the journey because what did you come into the world with?
My naked body.
Right. That's what you're going to leave with.
Yeah.
There's nothing from here we can take.
Right.
And so when you begin to realize that, you begin to realize, okay, this journey I have on is because God's got a purpose in it that's greater than what it is. Like even you and all your housing, like I was thinking about this, like when you said that about we want to make an experience for them, that might be the best thing that happens to any one of those people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It could be. It very well could be.
It's just the truth. That
a certain percentage. I mean,
for sure. Right? Or it might be the fact that someone wasn't, like I was thinking about the place you're renovating now where you guys have taken some videos of the changes.
But
is that the La Crosse place?
Yeah. You've probably seen some of those.
Pretty amazing. You look at that, like when you've had a hard day at work, could you imagine going home to that apartment building before?
Right.
Just even looking at the outside, like what you guys have done with the outside. Now, fortunately, cold's kind of probably messing with you a little bit, but you look at that, like that does something.
Mm-hmm.
It can lift someone's spirit or whatever it may be, right? And like, Joel, you have an amazing ability. That's one thing hopefully you appreciate, is you can take something and make it real. You make it an experience that people get lost in. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
And so I think even that, like whatever God's called you to do or you to do, there's a bigger reason to it.
I agree with that. That we don't always know maybe not, you know. And
may depending, know.
Right, may not ever know.
Yeah.
Because maybe it's 200 years before that true impact is actually,
right.
Or 500.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Right? Because you impacted somebody who impacted somebody who impacted somebody.
Yeah. And I think it's just but it's a wonderful journey
mm-hmm.
either way. And let's face it, guys, most of our problems are first world problems.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, we're pretty blessed from that aspect.
And I think I go back to how I said a lot of it's like water running off my back, like a lot of this stuff, because I think about that a lot of times.
Yeah,
I had my buddy in here who served a couple of tours overseas, Iraq, Afghanistan, and he talked about how, you know, they're just walking down the street one day and there's a gal, you know, basically kind of asking for food, but her dead baby was laying right in front of her. So he's like, I still think about that today. Like so then what happened was he came back. Then he went to college and there was people, you know, moaning in class and that he kept thinking about that lady, and all he had to give that lady on him was a bottle of water. He gave her the bottle. He's like, that bottle of water, you know, she probably was thankful for it, but man, that's like, That's nothing. Tough. That's not solving her problems, you know? Yeah. And then you come back here and it's like people complain about everything. And yeah, I mean, it's a lot of it is first world problems for a lot of people here. Obviously there's a lot of people that also deal with a lot of other problems. That,
they do.
You know, but yeah, I would say a vast majority of this stuff is first world problems for sure.
And I think like where we find these people that are desperate or hung, you know, or complaining or whatever. I think the other thing we've done is we've sold a lot of people the lie that they're just not very strong.
100%.
You know, you do need, you need codependence. You need codependence on this or that or whatever it may be. Because if you can make them codependent and weak, you can profit off of that. 100%. Now, I'm a free market guy.
Yeah,
I love capitalism. I don't care what anybody says.
Yeah.
But the reason why I like that is it enables me to do amazing things, not just for what we build in technology and you know, now I'm back into robotics on ag robotics again. And
are you really?
Yeah.
Now I'm going to have to pick your brain on that one.
But we've gotten back into that. And like one thing me and my wife talked about, you know, I've had a lot of offers for CEO positions, head of technology, innovation, for very good money. But my wife wouldn't let me do it. But she let me come back into the ag robotic space. You know, I bought the stuff back from Promach for that division. And she does that because we're going to change the world. It's about getting people healthier food, more readily accessible, things like that, right? And I think because we can go do that, it's because I believe that when my strength fails, God's is enough. And I think if we started changing the mentality of, listen, you're too weak to do that. Oh, no, you can't do that. We have to guard you. I just, a lot of what I do, like if I go to private schools, we do what's called a parents' night. And I'll speak, and then we do a Q&A. And what has happened is, as parents, these parents nowadays, they, and I would even say into the millennial generation, no offense to you guys, the parents have wanted to keep people from experiencing the hurt that they had. A noble thing. But what we did is, in the cause of trying to shelter them from the pain that maybe they went through, they have totally disregarded the fact that what better place for a kid to experience pain than when they're still underneath your roof?
Right.
What better place for your kid to experience coping? And I got a question for you along that line. What better place to learn how to negotiate with other people than under your care and the care of most people? Because I believe most parents want to do well.
So we're raising our daughter. 100%. And I got a 6-month-old in a couple of days. It'll be 6 months old, and they'll be the same thing for him.
Yeah. And why do we do that? Because we realize that they can either learn it now or like so many other millions of people, when they leave home, they don't know how to. And guess what happens? There's no coping mechanisms in place. So now what we do is we try to find the coping mechanism that doesn't deal with it, but just dulls it. Hence why we have alcoholism so high than ever, drug abuse higher than ever, opioid use higher than ever. We have sex trafficking higher than ever. And then we've also got suicide higher than ever.
And there's no better example of, hey, we're with the federal government and we're here to help than like Social Security. How much have people paid into Social Security and then to get $1,500 a month or $2,200 a month? I mean, if that would have been able to be invested in the stock market instead of going towards Social Security, how much farther ahead that person would be over all those years and all that amount of money?
100%. Look at Gronkowski.
Yep.
Yeah. I don't remember what he put in. It was, I think,
60 grand of Apple stock. I randomly saw that the other day. And I'm
like, what if anybody else would have done that?
Right.
You know, what better way? And I mean, that's kind of the cool thing about what you're doing too. It is the cool thing you're doing about it is you're like, hey, people, we can either invest this way or you can come invest with me. And now we're going to build something that's meaningful going through. There's a guy who I follow. And I remember he said this, he said, there's no more powerful way to live than to allow passive to pay bills.
100%. Yeah.
And I tell this all the time. I'll sit down 100%. With people. I don't know why everybody comes to me for financial advice. I'm the last person you want to get financial advice from, I think, sometimes. But
the key is to go broke many times.
That's what I tell them. That's what you got to do. Go broke several times, and then you'll learn. But me and my wife learned a few things. Number one, I told them, I said, listen, when me and my wife first got married, we had a lot of debt. I didn't know of a Dave Ramsey. So in 3 years, we got out of that debt. Then what we did is we took the only credit card we had left and we froze it in a big thing of water.
Yeah.
And what we'd do is we'd set it in the center of the table if we felt like we needed something with the credit card. We'd set it in there and we promised to pray about it until it was completely dry. Completely melted.
Yep.
Couldn't even have an ice cube in it. We never bought anything on that credit card.
Yeah.
Number two is never, ever put yourself in a situation where you are financially strapped to meet necessities of life.
Mm-hmm.
So you may want that new car. That's a $600 payment. But now all of a sudden you're strapped to meet necessities of life.
Right.
That's stupidity.
Yep.
And I don't mean that to be mean.
Yeah. It's the truth.
I tell people, if you want to be strapped for cash, do it one of three ways. Build something, risk something, or be so generous.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't, you know.
No, 100%.
But I think that's a much, and so like with you.
Because you got a chance of getting a return out of that. The car, right? Your risk and reward.
Right. Isn't very
good. Versus, you know, and a lot of times too, like when you do that, people think that the risk, I think a lot of times people blow up risk to be more than what it really is.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't realize how much upside is potentially out there.
Right.
They give too much credit to the risk and not enough credit to the other end of it, the reward. Right.
I also think that we always want risk at a guarantee.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what keeps people paralyzed. I remember Mary likes to tell this story. She's like, you know, Don's a huge risk taker, but he was always calculated. But she said his risks became different as we went out longer in life. And here's what I'll tell you. When I first started my business, I saw a maintenance company take a grinder and throw it in the dumpster. It was a Bosch grinder, really nice one. And I went in there, I'm like, hey, can I grab that? He's like, oh, well, the switch don't work. I'm like, does it run? He's like, oh, yeah, it runs like a horse. I'm like, great, I'll take it. Well, for me, that switch not working was worth the risk because it was free. Mm-hmm. I didn't have enough money to go buy one.
Right.
Well, 6 months later, that thing chewed my leg up. It got caught in my shirt, went into my pants, and I cut an 18-inch gash. It took me 2.5 hours to pick all the grinding wheel filings out of it.
Oh.
I then scrubbed it and washed it, and then I stitched myself together because I had no health insurance. Okay? That risk was worth it to me.
Yeah.
Right? But as I got older, I'm the guy at work like, hey, is that switch a little faulty? They're like, yeah, give me that. Because now I have the money
right.
to offset the risk.
Yep. Right?
I'd rather put my risk somewhere else, right?
Yeah.
And so we look at that, but we always want a risk with a guarantee. And this is what I tell everybody. The best guarantee we can get in risk is education,
mm-hmm.
is knowledge. That is 100% guaranteed in every risk. You will learn something if your eyes are wide open. The second thing is failure does not have to be final. Mr. Forbes asked me that, like, hey, Don, why do you think you and your team were so successful? We're good with failing. We were really, really good at failing. And we learned a ton. You know, the few projects we had that went good out of the box, that was rare. We didn't learn a lot.
Yeah.
We learned a lot in that failure. But that is such a bad, naughty, naughty word. UW-Madison, where'd you go to school?
University of Dubuque.
That's right. Good man.
Yeah. Whitewater for 1 year and then Dubuque for three.
UW-Madison. Love. I got a lot of friends that went there. We never had someone graduate from UW-Madison that I kept. It wasn't because they weren't smart. They were very, very brilliant. It was because they were taught the whole time in school that they'd never fail. Well, when you work for an organization like Quest, we were spending 95% of our money was going back reinvesting.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And the rest all went to the employees. We kept doing that, you know? So like when I say that, we'd pocket every year. One third went to the employees, one third went back to the business, one third went back to R&D. And so, but went back in the business was all, we loved R&D. But you fail a lot. And so we tell them when we sit them down, like, hey, listen, whatever your wages are, double to triple that, that's what you're gonna make in mistakes. We're okay with it. Just learn. That's what we ask. Don't make the same mistake twice. They'd get to their first mistake and they couldn't handle it.
Yeah.
Like literally, I cannot tell you how many phone calls I'd get from a manager at my business and be like, Don, this person's at home, they're wrecked, they're suicidal. Well, why? And we're like, their project didn't work. Okay. Are they redesigning it? No, he won't come in. He's just heartbroken. He's distraught. His mom called me. You know, things like this where...
Eighth place trophies and...
Right. Don't know how to cope. All that
stuff is... Yeah.
You were told you were going to do nothing but succeed.
Yeah.
And so we always knew we had good people when they failed. They're like, they'd be really hard on themselves, but they would just go right back to work.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And start working harder. And because there's education.
Those people fire me up. I love being around those people.
I do too. And we have a lot of them. Mm-hmm. I mean, at Quest, the whole company's built on that.
Yeah.
It really was. But I think we've made failure a naughty word. And we don't want to admit that it's not a bad thing to be fierce.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like I was thinking about this. Like my prayer this morning was this. I said, God, I pray today you make me fierce. May I love fiercely. May I forgive fiercely. May I be mercifully fierce. And may I be fiercely merciful. Lord, I pray that not only do you make me fierce in these areas, but may you make me fiercely courageous and courageously fierce. And may I do it all to honor you. And I think we've made being fierce a bad thing. It's just sometimes it's putting the wrong energy, right?
Yep.
And so for the entrepreneur that's out there, like one is find people who are brutally honest with you. I'll tell you the story. I won't say what the product was, but I had a guy call me. He's like, he's a good friend of mine. He's like, listen, I need you to help me out. I'm like, what? He's like, my son has the best idea in the world. And he's like, you got to check this out. I'm like, okay. And he's like, I'm getting ready to invest. It was about $11 million in it. And I'm like, that's pretty much his whole family's wealth. This guy did well in business. So I sit down with this guy. He pitches me the product, shows me the prototype. And I'm like, who told you this was a good idea? He's like, what? I said, who don't love you? He's like, well, that's the meanest thing anybody's ever done. I said, listen, I don't mean to be mean, but this is the worst idea in the world. It had to do with something for gaming.
Sure.
Okay. And he's like, why? And so we just started running through some scenarios and stuff. And here what had happened is he surrounded himself with everybody that loved him.
Yep.
And was afraid to hurt his feelings.
Get a bunch of yes men.
Yeah.
And so when I told him this, he goes back to his dad and he's crying to his dad, and his dad calls me up and he's like, hey, Don, you know, were you as rough on him as I thought you'd be? I said, I don't feel like I was rough. Like, I'm trying to prevent him from, I said, he's got better ideas. The guy had brilliant ideas, and I'll share that in a moment. But so we talked about this, and I said, listen, you have to be able to love your son to know that you're not in an objective place to criticize what he's making.
Yeah.
And he's like, well, what should I do? I said, I'll tell you what. I said, I know a good firm in San Diego. Run it by them.
Third party.
Yeah. So they ran it down there, and they're like, no, this is the worst idea ever. And it was. It was a horrible idea. The funny thing is this guy was a really good programmer. And he had some really cool ideas. Like I sat down, talked with him a few more times, and finally I said, hey, I think you should start working on that. He said, well, no one has a use for it. I said, no, not today. But I said, it'll probably take you about a year to get that together. I said, I promise there's technology coming that's gonna need that. Well, sure enough, he got far enough and he started realizing some stuff. And he's like, yeah, there's some uses for this. I said, 100%, especially with like verification,
mm-hmm.
online verification. And next thing you know, he sold it to one of the largest credit companies in the world and made millions and millions of dollars.
That's awesome.
But you need someone around you.
Same guy that you told no.
Yeah. Yeah. Great kid. And he's young. He's young, you know, young to me. But, you know, I think in that, just surround yourself with some people that are brutally honest.
Yeah.
Also people that will keep you accountable. And the last thing is, before you start on anything, and I've met with CEOs that have been in turmoil. I've met with CEOs that are willing to ready to quit. You get with a board of directors, and sometimes I'll get hired where they're like, listen, we need you to evaluate the senior management team. And you get an hour and a half to do this. And so, like, you got to be on your game. And a lot of it's just, honestly, I think just God has given me some discernment in some things because it's not my abilities, I'll tell you that. But in all of this, what I've learned is most of them, their problems will start getting resolved when I tell them you need to write down your tenets. I'm like a preacher when it comes to that. Like, no one should be running a company unless you can hand someone a piece of paper and say, this is how I make my decisions. This is the tenets. This is what I stand for. This is what the company, this is how I make my decisions. And so you have your vision statement. Your vision statement, in my mind, shouldn't be more than 3 to 5 words. Your mission statement should maybe at most be a sentence to two. Your tenants should support that. So think of it like a Roman building.
Mm-hmm.
Your columns are your tenants. And then the base footer and everything else is every tenant should have two or three measurables. And a lot of people ask this, like, especially when we talk about it, like, well, one of mine is character. How do you measure character? Well, can I ask you, who's your best friend?
My best friend's the guy that I had here on the show and did a couple tours in Iraq.
The military guy?
Yeah.
Who's your second best friend?
I mean, if I go back to my best friend, who's my best friend? I'd say my dad.
Okay.
Then he's probably my second best friend.
So you just rank them.
Yeah.
How can you rank friends? So we all do it.
Right.
You have an analysis. So yeah. When someone tells me, like, how do you rank character? Yeah. Well, what are two measurables to that? Like, in your mind, what resolves good character, right? And you come up with those. That way, number one is no matter what decision comes apart, because here's what happens. Like, I got off a phone call yesterday, and I looked at my son. My son's working with me. And I said, I wish some days I could be crooked. And he's like, no, you don't. And I'm like, no, this is what I mean. Like, that customer asked me a question, and my competitor had asked the question to gain for himself. And so that competitor just got a couple million dollar PO. And he asked me on my side what I thought, and I could have told him a lie and got money from him. And I said, no, I don't think this is the best venue what we're giving you. He's like, no, you don't? I'm like, no, I actually think there's a better idea. He's like, do you know what it is? I said, no, but give us a week and we'll come up with it.
Hmm.
And I could have just grabbed a couple mil. We could have gotten far enough down the line, be like, oh, you guys didn't see this come in. It's on you, you know? But I couldn't. And what I mean by that is I'm always coming back to my tenants.
Yeah.
Because there's going to be a time where there's pressure and where you're going to want to violate that. And if you have those as a reminder and you have people that are honest around you, right, you won't violate those. And that's honor. And if you look everywhere in the Bible, those who cling to honor, those who cling to goodness, those are good things. Now, I've met people with some tenants that are super crooked. That's a very clear indicator for me that we probably won't align well.
Right. But that makes sense.
And you know, when you begin to look at that, we can understand that then Hungary's not going to manipulate us.
Thank you for joining us for this week's podcast. We encourage you to come back next week for the second half of our interview with Don Wickstrom. We're going to go more into business, his business experience. We're going to deep dive into some bonus structures that he's implemented into his company that he advises on a lot of other companies. And just a whole lot more of his story. So, again, we appreciate you being here. Appreciate you listening or watching. Please click subscribe, like us, follow us on all the platforms. Can't wait to see you next week.